views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Descending from the tribes of Africa, inspired by the great black leaders.
Good evening. Welcome to Race Treaty. Tonight we have a very special guest, Dr. Vanilla Rando, as expected, to discuss implicit bias and the law. To give some background, there was a recent video that came out outlining a new study on implicit bias as relates to the law. And we've invited Dr. Vanilla Rando to discuss this. The video is called Implicit Bias: How Should Psychological Science Inform the Law? Basically, with the compilation of research concerning implicit bias, it's now becoming commonly accepted. In fact, I think recently the FBI chief mentioned that the police are subject to implicit bias. Our question tonight is will this open the door concerning international law, the race treaty, which basically requires not just intent, but the disparate outcomes. And that's the significant difference between international law and our civil rights law, is the disparate outcome versus intentionality. With civil rights law, you have to prove intent on the part of the discriminator, oppressor, violator of human rights, to prove he had intent, he, to discriminate against you, whereas with international law, the disparate outcome proves the point and the government body is obligated by law to adjust. And that has been a major problem in human rights law versus civil rights law. Our guest hasn't arrived as of yet, and we're hoping she will. We'll still go into the issue of intent doctrine and CERD, and we'll also discuss the issue of implicit bias. As relates to the implicit bias, this recent study that came out really opens up the door. It's almost a Pandora's box of sorts, to the fact that we are now, with the sciences, social science, psychology, sociology, are now accepting the fact that implicit bias is a ruling factor in the decisions of the law. It's also a loophole of sorts to say the discriminator didn't mean to discriminate or violate your rights. It was an innate implicit bias involved. Well, our question tonight, once Dr. Rando joins us, will be how do we bridge the sciences with the law so that they're all in one accord? Because as of now, they're separated, and it really has created a major problem for us concerning implementation of human rights. I'm I'm going to read an Obligations in Racial Discrimination Jurisprudence by Dr. Audrey Daniel.
Hello?
Yes, Dr. Hello? Randall?
Yeah.
Yes, Dr. Randall. Hi.
Yeah. Hi.
This is Race Treaty calling.
I'm glad you called me. I fell asleep.
Uh-oh, it's okay.
So I'm glad to be on.
Thank you for joining us.
Okay.
I had just a few notes because I really wanted to glean your insight. I know you have extensive background concerning implicit bias and the law.
Right.
I think that part of that reason is that dealing with international law, we're dealing with disparate outcomes, and there's been an avoidance in language and in act by the U.S. Government to include issues non-related to intentionality, like disparate outcome and implicit bias.
Right.
Our question tonight is, and I have a few, first of all, Dr. Randall, what is implicit bias?
Well, to start off with, let's start with bias, okay? Distinguishing stereotypes, prejudices, and biases. And biases is when you have a preference for or against something, okay? And then you can have an explicit bias. You can be explicitly for or against something, and that's when you know it. It's demonstrated in your language and your behavior. That's explicit bias. Implicit bias is when you are unaware, when you have you're unaware of the bias and it's working on a unconscious level. So, and a lot of times people confuse the two because they want to say that someone uses the N-word. That's not an implicit bias. That's an explicit bias. That's an explicit prejudice, an explicit stereotype. When we talk about implicit bias, it's a way of explaining how come people who say, and we'll take them at their word, that they don't have a bias, but obviously are demonstrating through the choices they make that they do have a bias, and it's on that unconscious level.
Well, Doctor, taking it from the unconscious level to the law, disparate outcomes, does that not reflect the implicit bias?
It can be explicit or implicit. Disparate impact is about the outcome. And that's one way to look, one way I tell people to look at it is that when you see a disparate outcome, you don't know whether this is the result of explicit bias or implicit bias. You just know that you have a disparate outcome, a disparate impact, a disparate outcome. If you look and there's no explicit, like there's no rule saying black people don't enter, there's no rule saying that people that they would charge black people more for loan, but nevertheless they're being charged more, that could be the result of implicit bias. It's definitely the result of policies and practices and procedures that have the effect of discriminating. All implicit bias does is help explain people's behavior. It doesn't actually, it's not a way of talking about the law in the terms of a legal concept. More appropriate would be disparate impact. We know intent, right? So we already know that you can intend to discriminate. We know that you can have a disparate impact where you don't intend to discriminate, but your behavior nevertheless results in discrimination. We also have negligent discrimination, which we don't talk about in this country at all, where you don't intend it. It may not be the disparate impact kind of thing in terms of impacting a lot of people, but your behavior, you engaged in behavior that had the effect of discrimination. Like when you go into a store, one way to think about it is if you go into a store, someone can throw water right in front of you and you can slip and fall. That's intentional. Someone can drop water on the floor knowing that you're going to walk in, but don't mop it up. That's negligent. They didn't intend for you to slip and fall, but their behavior resulted in you slipping and falling, and they should have known better and should have done differently. So you can have negligent discrimination. What implicit bias does, and I've been teaching it now for over 10 years, is to try to help people understand why when you have neutral laws on their face and you have people who claim that they don't have any biases, why you still end up with this disparate impact, end up with this discrimination.
That's very, very important, in my opinion, in trying to understand the distinction between intent-based standards and disparate impact standards. And what you explained with the implicit bias, how does that fit into the international law? In fact, I'd like to read an introduction by Audrey Daniel concerning the obligations of CERD. And it says, the United States ratified the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, but does not prioritize furthering its human rights objectives, specifically the intent doctrine, which requires that a plaintiff prove a perpetrator's intent to discriminate to win an equal protection claim. It violates CERD's very definition of discrimination, in fact. Utilizing a disparate impact standard of discrimination offers broad protections against modern forms of discrimination such as implicit bias and structural racism. Can you speak to that? Because in my opinion, from my understanding, at this point, CERD does not, in fact, provide the protections of against structural racism and implicit bias. And in the United States, of course, go ahead, please.
No, finish your thought.
Well, in the United States, of course, is based on the intent. And so we cannot legally frame the various forms of discrimination, which are many, that are excluded in the law in terms of the obligation on the part of the plaintiff to prove that he's been discriminated against. And so if you're dealing with an intent doctrine in civil rights law, and yet implicit bias is now becoming a word that's being embraced, a definition that's being embraced, where does that bridge come in? Does it come in federal civil rights law, or do we keep pushing to broaden the description to include implicit bias in the CERD law?
Well, first of all, I don't think of implicit bias, and I don't like to use it as a standard, standard concept. It really is about understanding how behavior is generated. Okay? So I would never think of implicit bias being a legal standard in the law by which someone would be responsible. Because what you're saying, we all have biases. We all have biases. And some of them are explicit and some of them are implicit. And when you're talking about racial bias, we, some of us have, it's important to me to distinguish between having stereotypes and prejudices and biases from discriminating. Okay?
Oh, that's hitting with the resulting impact, though, of discrimination, then.
The resulting impact is discrimination. And you're exactly right. And so we focus. All implicit bias does is help explain how you get discrimination without intent. But it's not a standard to be used in the law, in my opinion.
Well, that's kind of the nature of my inquiry this evening, and the fact that if, in fact, implicit bias is a factor towards the disparate outcomes, why then, as we deal with this legalistic definition, why is not the sciences of the modern day, the present day, sociology, psychology, why then isn't the definitions of the science, social sciences included or embraced in the law?
That's exactly right. The problem we have in the United States is that CERD, the race treaty, says that all forms of racial discrimination have to be gotten rid of, and so the point being is that they don't look just at intent, they look at effect, and I presume if you came up with another form of discrimination that was neither intent or effect but resulted in racial discrimination, CERD would cover it. Because CERD says eliminate all forms of the racial discrimination. The problem in the United States is we have had a long-standing focus only on intent, as you so rightly said. And even in regulation, the Title VI regulations has disparate impact. But 15 years ago, the Supreme Court says that no individual can sue under the regulation. So that means the only way we can sue as an individual is someone does something intentionally. Now, why is that? My thing is I believe that race discrimination, eliminating racial discrimination in this society has never been a high priority, and whenever they have done something, they've always done just enough to kind of take the pot off the fire, but not enough to actually make radical changes. And so, while the Title VI law does not at all say anything about intent, the courts have repeatedly interpreted as intentional. And basically because white men and women see themselves as being unjustly accused of discrimination when you talk about its disparate impact, when you talk about negligent discrimination, they are more afraid of being unjustly accused than they are of protecting the victim. Other areas of the law, and I've taught tort law and I've taught criminal law, and other areas of the law, when you have a victim, the law is set up to protect, to give the victim as many ways into the court as possible. So you can be held criminally responsible for negligent homicide. So you didn't intend to kill that person. You got in behind the car drunk. No intent. but you were
you
negligent.
Tried under that. That's right.
You can be tried under negligent homicide. You can be taken to court, and this is what happened to OJ. You can be taken to court and tort law and be found negligent. The standard is lower than criminal law. So that in those areas of law, criminal law and tort law, the law gives multiple ways for the victim to have redress. It is only in the area of discrimination law where the victim has only one redress, and that's intent. And I think that's deliberate. That is white supremacy protecting itself from having to make radical change. Because just imagine if our law recognized disparate impact and people could sue for disparate impact and negligent discrimination. All of the disparities we see in this society, for the most part, will go away.
Well, speaking of them going away, they have not been included in the definitions of discrimination and racism. And it would seem to me that, be it that racism is systemic, that you would take a systemic approach to including all the definitions and variables involved in discrimination. And to that point, the U.S. has gone even further with the Washington versus Davis U.S. Supreme Court case, which basically says that established that laws have a racial discriminatory effect, but that were not adopted to advance racial discriminatory purposes are not valid under the U.S. Constitution. I don't fully understand how it could not be under the U.S. Constitution, but then that reverts back to the whole legal framework of three-fifths humans for African Americans, and you can't amend that definition in the founding document of this country.
Well, the thing is, I truly do not like to talk about what the Constitution will or will not allow, because we know that the Constitution is all a matter of interpretation, and that what is allowed under the Constitution is whatever 7-9 men and women want to say it allows, and consequently, Native Americans, African Americans, blacks, Asians, Japanese, internment, most people don't even realize now that the Japanese internment of Japanese in concentration camp, the case that said that was constitutional is still good law. That means that the United States could, under that case, and I'm drawing a blank for the name right now, under that case, the court said, if there's a national security problem, race can be used to intern its citizens. And that case has never been overthrown. So
that case, and then you have also 1991, Congress amended the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and codified the disparate impact test, establishing Graves versus Duke. And it and basically
for employment law, but not for not for race.
Right. But however, Justice Scalia indicated in his concurring opinion that the disparate impact provisions of Title VII may be unconstitutional.
Well, I mean, yeah, it may be unconstitutional because he believes it's unconstitutional. And if he can get 5 or 6 or whatever number it is to agree with him, then it will be unconstitutional. And then 50 to 100 years from now, another court will come along and say, oh, no, it's not unconstitutional. There's nothing magic about the Constitution. And there's nothing magic in...
we're signees to a race treaty, Dr. Randall, and although, you know, we're functioning under the constitutional law, we are also have signed and are partners with this human rights law that the majority of the world's population enjoys. Yet we have gone through great measures to undermine that international law and not comply. And meanwhile, there's no accountability.
The thing is there is no accountability, because when we sign on to human rights treaties, and this is mostly human rights treaties, we always sign on to them in a way that provides American citizens no more rights than what they already have under the constitutional interpretation. And so our signing on to the race treaty, which we didn't do, as you can remember, it wasn't ratified until, 1994?
Yeah,
The treaty was passed in 1966-65, and we didn't ratify it as a document until 30 years later. But even with that ratification, we put restrictions on it. America's role, for all our discussion of human rights in other countries, we restrict the human rights that are available in this country, either by not signing the treaty, so like the Rights of the Child Treaty we have not signed, or we sign with such restrictions that they don't have any legal effect in this country. So right now, the race treaty has no legal effect in this country. You can't go to court and use it like you can with other non-human rights treaties and use it as law. And under the Constitution, treaties are supposed to be the law of the land, but the United States has consistently signed them in a way that says, no, we're not making human rights treaties the law of the land. We're just signing them for show.
So basically, our United States citizens and our partnership or signing to a treaty with the rest of the world called the Race Treaty, CISER, it's basically public relations. It has no intent to have an impact or compliance in this country. It's just basically a showpiece.
No, that's exactly right.
But yeah, here's the thing, Dr. Randall. I'm not personally concerned, but I've been observing that under CERD, this international human rights law, there has been some movement for protection for LGBT discrimination issues, and that it's been invoked. And in addition to that, you made a real keen point in that United States does not really have a human rights infrastructure. An example would be that the Canadians, neighbors of Detroit citizens, had to come across the bridge, observe this water turn off as a human rights violation, and then the Canadian human rights groups approached the United Nations concerning Detroit. Why? Because Detroit, as with the general population in terms of the U.S., does not have a strong human rights infrastructure. Our human rights seems to be focused outside of the U.S. rather than internally, where the violations are taking place every day for people of color.
Well, we know we live in a fascist state. We know we live in a military state. And we know if we were to step back and assess our countries, we know that the violations of human rights here, the poverty, the children in poverty, the mass incarceration, the use of prison labor, the low wages that that people are being paid that makes it impossible for them to have a decent life. These are all human rights violations. The education system that is sending people from school to prison. These are human rights violations. And in even the healthcare, they recently passed the Affordable Care Act, but all the Affordable Care Act does is give you an insurance. It doesn't actually put a provider in your community, and it doesn't actually deal with the fact that providers are discriminating against black even when they have the same insurance. And so when you look at all of the areas where we have human rights violations, but one of the things that has happened is the United States, and this has been smart on their part. Part of what they're supposed to do as a part of signing these treaties is to conduct widespread human rights education. The United States doesn't do that.
On that point, we're going to take a quick break, Dr. Randall. We've got a 9:30 break for like 2 minutes, and I'd like to come back and deal with that issue specifically, the human rights, but also to revisit this law that you referred to, and our host, Scotty, gave me the case site. It's Korematsu versus the United States.
Exactly.
It was the landmark Supreme Court case, but while there were Japanese interned, people don't seem to understand there are also African Americans interned in Mississippi into internment camps. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
This is Elliot Booker, host of Time for an Awakening Radio on the Black Talk Radio Network, speaking in behalf of the Black Talk Media Project's 2015 fundraiser. Since 2008, the Black Talk Media Project, which has created Black Talk Radio Network, has engaged in producing original content from a black perspective for the global black community. You can help us continue this mission and help us even more by giving donations to the Black Talk Media Project's 2015 fundraiser and asking others to do so also. Let us work together to make 2015 a stronger year for independent black media. Again, this is Elliot Booker of Time for Awakening Radio Program on the Black Talk Radio.
Yes, thank you. Dr. Randall?
Yes.
You know from your personal dealings with me that I'm committed to a human rights movement, as are many, many people across the country. Yet, the Black Lives Matter movement, the Ferguson organizing efforts, I have yet to really hear or see that the human rights lens is being embraced by these movements. And I keep hearing the rejuvenation of the second civil rights movement, and that kind of causes me pause. But at the same time, you made a real poignant point, is that we're kind of in a no-win situation here, in the fact that the United States legal structure has not addressed the issue of systemic racism in this country. And yet, at the same time, they've neutered or neutralized any accountability in terms of the international law. And so,
yeah, and, you know, I think one of the reasons we haven't heard a lot of from the Black Lives Matter and other groups about human rights is because people just really don't understand the human rights component and how it should be addressed as the basic approach, and not civil rights. That we're not looking for civil rights, we're looking for human rights and how we side the treaty. Now, even though the treaty doesn't have legal force, I think that that it has, by signing on to it, we can still use it to shame them. We can still use it in the work we do, and we certainly can go to the UN and provide testimony and information on how the United States is not living up to its responsibility under the treaty. Different administrations will find that problematic or not. You know, it's kind of like some administrations will say, I don't care what the UN says. But other administrators who are trying to use the UN in some way may be a little sensitive and will make some movement because of that.
Well, when you speak of movement, Dr. Randall, I've heard this term used a few times in the human rights network, and that is the shaming. The only outlet for the violations of law is to shame the perpetrator or the violator, and then if you don't have control of the media mechanism, that whole apparatus can shut down any dissent being put to the public concerning these issues. So where are we at?
The shaming is an interesting concept because I kind of believe that you have to not be a sociopath. And I think the United States is run by sociopaths. You're not going to be ashamed of something, if you don't have a social emotional connection. And I think it's clear that as a country, I think we are more pretty sociopathic in our behavior. But I do believe shaming is to this point. If there is an immediate goal that the United States wants, and our voice might cause them not to be able to meet that goal as easily, then they will be interested in making some changes.
Well,
I'm not saying major changes. I don't get me wrong. I'm not sure short of revolution that there's anything to be done to move the United States as a body. It's entrenched in its white supremacy and its corporatist capitalist approach, and the treaties have been signed in such a way we don't have a way of educating even lawyers about human rights law.
Right.
So lawyers go to law school and never take a course on the human rights treaties. Never.
Well, those who have taken courses on human rights in my dealings with, you know, the Shadow Report, and I noticed that the legal heads, they have the great description, the concise description of discrimination as relates to CERD, but they don't have an analysis of white supremacy or systemic racism.
Exactly.
So I still see the law as almost like an island in referencing how we define racism and white supremacy. And as far as accountability, it's excluded as an abstract framework in dealing with human rights law. And as far as the shaming, you hit upon a point that kind of really hit home with me anyway, in that we've got a 10-year decade for those of African descent around the world. From the beginning when I heard about it, I said, well, this is a great opportunity for a united global African descent folks to address the issue of white supremacy and racism. And yet, in reality, the UN seems to be more like a lamentation and celebration rather than a think tank period, a 10-year period where we can benchmark a global onslaught on white supremacy. And you talk about shaming, I think we need to have a global shaming because this racism is going on globally. It is a system. and yet we kind of cherry pick and isolate the description and definition of racism vis-a-vis the U.S. government as meaning that you have to prove that someone had intent to discriminate. At the same time, we have all of these research outcomes concerning implicit bias, meaning that a majority of discriminatory behavior is already unconscious. And so you can't hold the unconscious culpable with intent. So it's a real tricky course we are on. And as all of our human rights are being violated here in the U.S., there's daily headlines that should be more than shaming. In fact, they've brought it to another level in that now the new trend is snuff films. You know, these the police killing innocent citizens on camera, and it becoming a big trend, is a snuff film. A
government showing it over and over again on television.
That's the thing. There ain't no shame. You don't shame a psychopath who lacks empathy, and you don't shame a system that is built to oppress that lacks empathy. There's no shame to it. The shame should be a self-invoked shame for writing off the treaty with a reservation, saying, yeah, this is a great law, but we don't want to apply it here because we have to maintain white supremacy. I mean, I'm being kind of, you know, cynical about it, but it seems like, you know, our backs are against the wall. I post every day headlines on human rights violations. They're framed differently. It's school to prison pipeline, it's health disparities, it's hiring practices, housing, in all areas of people activities, we're addressing human rights violations. And yet we're unable to frame our issues within a human rights lens and bring it to the international arena. And we're only left with shaming. And that even with the shaming, that's really a very limited approach in that we just don't have the media apparatus to frame these violations.
Well, I think we don't have the media apparatus to make it. We don't have the human rights education apparatus so that we educate organizers and protesters and the everyday person and lawyer on the treaties. One of the ways to get the treaty to be more effective is to get it, there's a couple of ways. One way is to get it adopted on local levels, and we've talked about this. Another way is to get courts to use the language in cases. That is, if lawyers would begin to use the treaty in their cases, and courts would begin to adopt some of the language, lower courts adopt some of the language, then that would give the treaty some effect. But lawyers don't know that, they don't know anything about the treaty. And they've been taught this thing, which it's factually true, that the treaty doesn't have any power of legal precedent in the, without being, adopted, by a municipality or a state or the federal government. But that doesn't mean that it can't be used to give an indication to the court about what the rest of the world is doing and using the treaty to make an argument for changing American law. We don't see any of that going on. The treaty is, for America, mostly a showpiece.
So there's no possibility of a class action lawsuit in international courts for violations of CERD?
No. And the reason there isn't, this goes back to what I was saying earlier. In order to bring a lawsuit in international court based on the treaties, the state, the United States, Canada, whoever, has to give you permission to do it. And the United States specifically excluded that. So we can't sue. We, you know, in some countries, they sign these treaties and then people take their, like you said, take their country to court, to international court for violation of the treaty. Well, the United States specifically refused to give that option to its citizens. We're really, when it comes to human rights, we are really cut off.
Yes, we are.
I mean, the only thing, I'm going to Geneva the 1st of May, and, you know, I think it's an important thing to do. You go, you testify, you take the papers, and they write up stuff, you know, and I think they do listen. And it's reflected in the reports that come out on the United States, but since the United States really don't care, it doesn't mean, I mean, you know, it doesn't go any further than that except a paper trail.
Well, there is this obligation coming out of the recent shadow reports on the part of the U.S. government saying in response to its violations, well, we'll accept training. We'll accept training. Is there a training apparatus in place to train federal governments and lawyers and civil rights, more importantly?
No, there is not. This is the problem. There is no, and they haven't put in place a training apparatus. And there was a push to try to get the civil rights, the Office of Civil Rights, rededicated to be the Office of Civil and Human Rights. And every administration, including the Obama administration, has resisted that.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's clearly the myth that is promoted is that Americans have the best constitutional rights there are. People don't understand the Constitution when they say that. Because the Constitution is all about, is not about substantive rights. The Constitution is only about procedural rights. So you don't have a right to food, housing, clothing, education, as a matter of a constitution.
Human rights, basically.
Yeah. You don't have any human rights under our constitution. You have the right not to be interfered with without due process, is what I tell people. They can even take your life under our constitution as long as they give you due process.
Well,
and so,
you know,
the Constitution of the United States is a very restricted, limited document when it comes to human rights. And they want to keep it that way, and they don't want people, mainly because when you start saying people have human rights, then you got to provide it to them. And if you provide them, you gotta take the money from somewhere.
Yeah, that's just too real, right? Treating folks like humans.
Yeah. You know, like, you know, there was some court said that they didn't see water as a basic human right.
Well, you know, we in this country place this Constitution as like next to the Bible. It's like this really great document, and yet the amendments aren't really like a due process. In other words, civil rights didn't come out of the Constitution. Civil rights came out of a different type of law. And
that's right.
And then you have the 13th Amendment with its double talk, double speak, talking about, you know, the exception, which they've
you can get rid of slavery except if it's penal slavery. You can, if it's in penal in servitude.
And then we have, you know, we have the Black History Month where everyone starts touting the 14th Amendment. And this was my issue with the Occupy Wall Street folks, is that the 14th Amendment really granted the power of personhood to corporations. While on the face of it, they were freeing slaves, allegedly.
Yeah.
But really, in the course of law, there were like 134 cases.
I don't agree with that. The 14th Amendment didn't grant any kind of personhood to corporations. None whatsoever. Seven justices decided to do that. Nothing that's in the 14th Amendment requires corporations to have personhood. And they could just as easily interpret it as, and this is all, this whole corporation is personhood is a campaign that started in the late 1900s. It's a relatively new thing. And it could be changed just as easily as it would. So I think the biggest problem that I have with the equal protection, and again, there's nothing wrong with the language of the Constitution. This is why you can't go to language. But the problem becomes is it's now being used for everything but what it was intended.
Corporations are now filing under civil rights laws for protection of their interests.
Yes.
And I don't know how they're going to improve intent, but they seem to be rallying around the civil rights law for protection. Meanwhile, Dr. Randall, in your opinion, is there a hope and a future for the human rights movement?
Well, I don't, you know, in my opinion, there has to be hope, and there has to be we have to work on human rights, and we have to, just as we for human rights in violations that occur in other countries, we have to develop some mechanisms in here in the United States to first educate people. And this is why I'm so happy you're doing this Race Treaty TV, because I think that this is a big part of educating people about the lack of human rights in this country and the treaties we have signed on to, and how we can get the United States, if we could ever find the lever to make them make a change. They can change how they operate under the treaty.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think that it's something that's going to happen in my lifetime? No, because I'm at the end of my lifetime. I'm 70 years old, and I don't think it's going to happen in the next 20 years.
Well, Dr. Randall, I would like to have more... you know, I want you to see it in your lifetime. I want to see it in mine as well. But speaking to a human rights movement, we don't have a really established human rights infrastructure here in the U.S. If you go down the list of the human rights agencies, they're dealing with everything but racism, white supremacy, or systemic racism, which brings me to a point. I think as well as the government being obligated to understand its obligations under CERD, I feel that civil rights and the human rights infrastructure in this country, or lack of as far as human rights, are obligated to understand not just the CERD law, but have a reference point to frame it in terms of the analysis of white supremacy. It seems like there's a divide between CERD as this anti-discriminatory law, just like civil rights law is supposedly anti-discriminatory, but it's never framed with the reference of a systemic analysis of racism, of white supremacy.
Well, that's because, first of all, no one really talks about CERD in the context. The civil rights organizations are not referencing human rights. And you're absolutely right. A big step towards educating people about human rights is if the if every single civil rights organization in this country would begin to reference human rights and teach yes. people about it, that would go a long way to developing a human rights structure for education and for lobbying and for pushing human rights forward. But the civil rights organizations don't. And the other problem is, and this goes back to attorneys, people want easy wins. And so they want to go with laws, they want an easy win. And they don't realize that every advancement in race area in this country took decades, if not multiple decades of losing to be able to get a win. And so if people aren't willing to push forward and lose, they're never going to have a win.
Dr. Randall, that being the case, I'm still flustered over the issue of implicit bias as now being accepted in our conversations as a factor, and how much of a factor in discriminatory practices is implicit bias. And what obligation then, in fact, does the law have to include the science in its decision-making process for discrimination?
Well, see, and this goes back to me, to what I was saying again. I do not see a discussion of implicit bias as a standard in the law. I see it as a way of helping people understand their behavior and helping them to avoid discrimination by making their biases explicit and then making a decision not to act upon them. I think the law has every responsibility to train everyone about how to do that. How to know whether you not have implicit biases, how to avoid having the implicit biases impact your decision making, how to know whether implicit biases are impacting your decision making, whether you be a judge, a juror, a police officer, whatever. I think that the law has to incorporate that. But I want to be clear, though, I don't think implicit bias is a form of discrimination.
All right. I hear you, Dr. Randall, and we're speaking about this implicit bias, but what about the impact? The impact is post-traumatic stress disorder stemming from racism, and it does affect the whole populace. And based on the focus on the impact of this law, doesn't that help us move this towards another type of conversation and towards the victim of white supremacy?
Well, I think, are you asking me if a focus on implicit bias helps us move towards the victim? Is that what
right.
you're asking?
Yes, ma'am.
I think that that we need to move the law towards the victim.
Yes.
And I think that implicit bias helps to get people to understand why we need to move towards the outcome and the impact. So that if you focus only on intent, you're going to miss most of what goes on.
That's the point here.
But here's the deal that I think. We should never, never have to try to prove whether an implicit bias exists. It should only be an explanation. All we need to prove is impact.
Yes. Yes, I like that.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes. because that's the long-standing outcome is the impact, is the oppression on the part, you know, that's being the plaintiff and the defendant, and really, that's where we're at. We're going to have to...
I think if we go down the road of saying that we want implicit bias to be a standard, it's going to be a hard standard to prove. But we can never prove whether someone, it'll be hard to make all the connections, but we can always prove the impact.
Well, for victims of white supremacy who live with the impact every day, and as tests and measures are coming out that display that impact, I think that may be the way to go, is the effect and impact as with the disparate outcome for the unjust laws. We're going to end the show today, and we're going to invite you back, Dr. Rando. Hopefully next week. Continue this conversation, and if we don't get you next week, and we know you're leaving for a month or so, wish you well on your travels, and stay in touch, Dr. Randall. Love you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.